Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, September 12th. I'm Ray Graff. Time again for another science forum on this show. We've got our panel of experts ready to field your scientific inquiries. The number is 800-348-2551. If you have a question, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551, the Science Forum. Your calls are coming up. By the way, this program is a Minimum Fun production. We'll be back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum. The experts are here ready to answer your questions. If you have a science question, call us, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. If you wish, you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or call 800-348-2551. Yes, it's the Science Forum. Let's have our panel of scientists sign in, please.
Hi, Barbara Brabetz. I am a biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill.
Hello, I'm Kevin Knuth. I teach physics at University of Albany.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, mostly retired now.
I'm Ed Stander. I wish I was mostly retired, but I'm not, and I teach at SUNY Cobleskill.
All right, great to have you all back on the show here. How's school going?
Yeah, last time we were here, school had not yet begun. We are in the thick of it. It is the almost end of week 3 of 15, so we're chugging
really?
Right along.
That's terrific.
Yeah, nobody's dropped yet.
No, and you're having fun? Teaching the young scamps?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ed,
you didn't say
that.
We're having fun.
Ed, Ed nodded on the radio.
That's, all right. Fair enough. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Kevin Knuth, great to have you on the program. Let's pull Kevin's mic a little closer. Just
He's teaching too.
I should have thought of that before the show, moving his mic, which is sad because I was a roadie for Molly Hatchet for many years. All right, Kevin, how are things going at school for you?
Very good. I'm teaching a class on data analysis and another class on electromagnetism.
Interesting. What do you know about anti-gravity?
We don't know much about it yet.
Really?
Yep.
I'm reading a book and they intimate that it's all figured out by now. You put a bubble around the object and it's kind of short on details.
Stuff, yeah.
So are you skeptical of anti-gravity? Will it ever be a thing?
Maybe someday. Some people are trying.
That's very non-committal.
Do you find the book is very light?
The book is very light.
It's light reading, yes.
The more pages I read, the lighter it gets. It's amazing. All right, we had homework last time, didn't we?
We did. Both Ed and I had homework that was gastronomic or at least non-potent potable in origin.
Yes.
What you said.
It was almost like a Food Friday.
Really?
Yeah.
Only more exciting, no doubt. All right, what do you got?
I'll start with mine. We had a caller who called in and wondered why his microwaved coffee seemed to cool down faster than his brewed coffee from the coffee pot.
Oh, yeah.
And insisted that they were starting at the same temperature and in the same mug, but somehow the dissipation of heat from the microwaved coffee was happening faster than the one from the brewed. So, you know, there's a lot of factors that could be variable. We have to try to create an even playing field. So I did the experiment, and I figured out to what temperature my microwave on the coffee button setting reheats the coffee, and in Fahrenheit it's about 140 or so. And then checked my coffee pot, and my coffee pot, it comes in a little hotter than that. So I upped the time on my microwave so it would be the same temperature as my coffee pot. And then I sat them with two thermometers in them next to each other and watched them cool. And it was shockingly like watching two warm pots of coffee cool. They were cups. It was pretty boring and pretty much the same. So if anything, the microwaved cup had a little slower decline. And we had talked about that during the show because the cup also gets heated when it's in the microwave, whereas your cup that you pour coffee into from your coffee maker is at room temperature before you pour the coffee.
Why don't you pour both coffee
more homework
into different vessels very for a short amount of time and then put them into the vessel that are both at room temperature You know what I mean? Right, so then you're not seeing any of the effects of the microwave on the structure of the cup.
Correct, because we had talked about that also with the caller, and he was insistent. He was seeing the mic. So I was trying to give the conditions that would most approximate what he described on the radio.
Uh-huh.
If you use the same cups that were at the same temperature and then you took the stuff from the microwave and poured it into those cups, then it would be exactly the same as it was, which is they're still the same.
Okay.
So, Ray, you could be a peer reviewer for...
You could.
Yes.
And send me to do more coffee homework.
Yeah.
Because one thing science needs is more radio hosts doing peer reviews. So, yes, you made a good point, Chip. All right, Ed, you had some homework as well.
Yeah, I had a much more complicated one.
Oh, you had a more delicious one.
It was, but it was more complicated. I had to determine whether chocolate ice cream was colder in the mouth than vanilla ice cream.
Okay. What
and
brand?
So, I made my own.
You made your own? What was the overrun?
I wanted to make sure. I'm going to charge WAMC for the price
of
this.
The overrun is the amount of fat. The amount of air.
The amount of air.
That they pump into the ice cream.
Well, I have, this is one of the reasons I did it, is I have a very, very good ice cream maker.
Okay.
Only
I spent
the best.
Years. Yeah, the very the best.
Of course.
And so I made the two of them according to the usual methodology in this thing. Made the custard, put it in the fridge, made sure it was the right temperature, took it, made the ice cream, then put the ice cream in the freezer. And when I took it out, I made sure the temperature of the two of them was exactly the same.
Okay.
And then I put it in my mouth. I was going to do a double blind test. But it didn't make any sense because you can tell which one's chocolate and which one's vanilla.
True.
So it wasn't really worth it.
Okay.
But for my own sake, for my own tasting, they were both excellent. I made it.
Okay.
Very good ice cream.
Good to know.
Yes.
Not exactly part of the parameters of the reason for it.
I could not tell the difference between the two of them as far as temperature was concerned.
And how many times did you repeat this trial?
Hundreds of times.
Until it was almost empty. I wanted to make sure there wasn't a question about the amount of ice cream or where it was in the container.
Oh, or any pre-cooling of the mouth that might have happened by the prior bite.
That's right.
Yes. When did you come out of the coma?
Who says he's out?
Ouch. All right. It's the Science Forum today. Barbara Brabitz, Kevin Knuth, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander here to answer your questions. 800-348-2551 is our number. If you have a science question, you can email as well, voxpop@wamc.org. And some people have done that. This one came in very early this morning. Al writes in, could you ask the science panel to discuss decompression sickness, a.k.a. the bends? Does it affect only scuba divers? Would someone going into a deep cave be affected, or high-altitude mountain climbers? And that's from Al.
Yeah, so the bends is where, 70%, 71% of our atmosphere at sea level is made up of nitrogen gas, which we do not really pay much attention to as we breathe it in and exhale it back out. Any gas is compressible in a pressurized system. so given the fact that we're meant to be at sea level, this nitrogen comes in and it goes out, and we have some that's dissolved in our blood, but it's not a problem. The problem comes when you're at pressure, and then more of that nitrogen that you breathe in is going to then dissolve into your blood. So the concentrate, you know, just like pressurizing a soda bottle, right? You can get more into solution.
Mm.
And if you stayed at that pressure, it would be fine. Breathe in, breathe out, and no problem. It's when you have a change in pressure back up to the surface where then you lower the pressure that the person is in, these gas bubbles come out of solution, just like cracking the top of a brand new 2 liter of Coca-Cola, you're going to get the bubbles that form, and those bubbles that form is decompression sickness.
Okay.
And it can do quite a lot of damage, especially in the brain.
All right. Anybody else?
Well, the mountain climbing.
No.
One is that the pressure difference isn't very great. And second, you're changing the pressure very slowly.
Yeah.
So you have a chance to equilibrate. One place where apparently this was a factor is in the SpaceX mission that's going on now.
Mm. Which is very interesting.
Yes. Where they went through, a 2-day... gradual changeover from whatever their standard atmosphere is to a lower pressure, pure oxygen.
Prior to launch or
prior to opening the door?
After they were in orbit.
So they're about 700, 800 miles, right?
Well, it's probably an elliptic orbit. So yeah, it gets occasionally that. But because they were going to entirely evacuate the capsule.
Because there's no airlock.
Right, because there's no airlock.
They might have thought of putting one in.
Right, they just did the EVA, and they needed to depressurize the whole cabin.
Yeah, so, and apparently in the suits, they're using low pressure of pure oxygen so you don't blow up like a balloon.
Right.
And they had to do that slow changeover to prevent nitrogen bubbles from forming.
Yeah, and the big thing, the big difference with air and water is water is an awful lot heavier. So you can go a long way. You don't have to go that far down in the water before the pressure builds up enough so that when you come up, you can cause air bubbles in your bloodstream. On the other hand, you can't get that deep in a cave. I think the deepest cave that there is on the face of the Earth is on the order of 2 miles. And the pressure, the barometric pressure at that depth is not that high.
As long as it's a dry cave, right? If you're underwater, in a cave, that's a different
bets are off.
Yep.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum today with Kevin Knuth, Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. And the spacewalk was interesting. I think the billionaire got a little scared and he stayed halfway in there holding very tightly. But it was, I mean, I admire him for doing it. Were they in the Van Allen belt? How far up were they? I couldn't quite figure out. I had heard on NPR that they were up in a radiation belt. Yeah. Is there another radiation belt that I don't know about?
No, they're at highest altitude in the orbit. They're on the lower end of the Van Allen belt.
Okay.
And it's not a particularly good time to be there because we're getting hit by a lot of solar material right now.
Yeah.
In fact, for those who are listening, they're expecting on the 13th the possibility of a major aurora associated with the stuff that's coming in right now.
Huh. All right. Let's see. This is from...
We'll see it here in New York, you think?
They say that's very possible. It's either going to be a G2 or a G3, depending on... there's between 2 and 4 CMEs, coronal mass ejections, that are coming towards us. If they start adding up to each other, depending on how fast they come in, it could very well cause a major aurora.
I mean, depending on where you are, the ambient street light and city light is so difficult. You have to stand out for 4 hours to get your eyes ready to see anything like that.
Right, that's why we're
very frustrating.
That's why we're in Cobleskill.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Don't rub it in.
I did happen to ask the world how high up this orbit is going, and the maximum elliptical on the orbit is 755 miles.
Oh, okay. You know,
so pretty far.
I saw on TV, what day did it launch? Monday?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I watched the launch on TV as I was having my coffee early in the morning. I didn't realize if I had stepped outside moments later, I would have seen the thing. Somebody in Gloversville had a beautiful shot. They had great shots of this rocket launch in New York City.
Yep.
Why do I always not think? Why, Ed? Why?
Oh, because you're a radio announcer.
Exactly. Number one answer. Nick writes in, we got to take a break. Zach, the engineer, is flailing around. Stop it. 800-348-2551, the Science Forum. We're having so much fun, believe it or not, that we missed the break. Yeah, okay, here we go. For minimum fun here, it's Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. Ray Graff with you, joined by Jim Pickett, Kevin Knuth, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabets. It's the Science Forum, and we are actually having a good time here thus far. Pamela writes in from Troy. I was out kayaking shortly after sunrise this morning. The reservoir we were on had a light mist in a few places, and at one point we were paddling through it. It was quite visible a few feet away, but as we went through it, it wasn't really visible close to the boat. Was that boat disturbing the air in such a way as to keep the mist from being close to it, or was it more an optical issue, as in too close up, it was too wispy to see and only looked more solid at a different angle, which had the mist layered more thickly as I looked at it from the side instead of down on it from above? Aside from getting up stupid early, it was a lovely morning. Well, Pamela, thank you for sharing. All right, panel, what do you think?
My answer is yes.
Come on.
Well, both are possible. You'd have to have been there to actually see it.
Yeah.
I mean, One possibility is that the fog was actually lifting because she was out there when the sun was starting to come up. Mm. Another possibility was that she may have been disturbing the air enough to, probably unlikely enough to cause a slight change in humidity because the dew point probably stayed the same. And the other possibility is that you can't see the fog when you're that close to being inside of it.
Yeah, because the pond itself could be just a hair warmer than the air itself. And so you don't, right by the water, say a foot or two, you won't get formation of that fog. But you'll have it just above there where it's a little bit colder. And so if she's disturbing that warm-ish air and mixing it with the colder air just above, then the whole thing could just kind of collapse and you don't get that fog feel. I guess the big question is you'd know if you were in the fog if you could feel the dampness on your skin, right. like you're going through cobwebs of liquid.
Hmm.
See, if this is like a – did it start off where she could see the fog bank and then paddled into the edge? Well, when you're outside, mm-hmm. you're seeing the light that's being scattered from the bank, from the entire bank. It's like when you're flying above the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, the clouds are blinding white because you're getting all that reflection. Mm-hmm. When you descend and go through the clouds, now you're gray.
Yeah.
Because you're seeing scattering from a smaller volume.
Mm. Kevin.
Yeah, well, that's basically right. When you look at a cloud bank, you're basically getting light scattered off of the entire cloud bank because you can see through it. So each part of the cloud bank at each depth is scattering some light back at you. And then as you get into it, you're not looking through the whole cloud bank anymore. You're only looking through a portion of the cloud bank. So you're getting scattered light from only part of that cloud bank. So it could look lighter.
So when a cloud comes over, and we saw this the other day, some puffy cumulus. It was a beautiful blue sky. But there were a couple clouds on the horizon that were black underneath. That's just an illusion? Or are they filled with more moisture? Or is it just shadow? I mean, what are we seeing?
Well, they've scattered enough light. If you're looking at it from the top.
No, I wasn't.
No. But if you were,
right.
It would be very bright white simply because you've got more droplets in there scattering the light. So when you're looking up at it, because all that light has been scattered away, it looks dark.
Kind of shadowy.
And, of course, the thickness of the cloud. The thickness of the cloud matters as well. You'll lose more light as it goes through if it's a thicker cloud, which is why cumulus clouds tend to have black bottoms, while cirrus don't.
Ah, well, it's the Science Forum today. Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, Kevin Knuth, and Barbara Brabets are with us. 800-348-2551 is the number. And let's start with Joan in Schenectady. Joan, what it is?
Hello, Ray. I appreciate your intros, as always.
Thank you.
And hello, wonderful science people and science teachers, especially. I have a fondness for teaching. Two quick comments, and then I get to my real question, Ray.
Okay.
In regard to the minimum fund production?
Yes.
I would have to rate this a medium rare production.
Well, that's very kind of you, Joan. I'll let you back on the show. Thank you.
We made it up to mediocre.
I got to tell you, no, not mediocre. Medium, as in what a terrific use of this particular medium.
Oh.
And rare, as in what a rare mixture of science and entertainment.
Well done.
Ta-da.
Thank you, Joan.
That's what I'm here
Thank
for.
You. Appreciate it.
Yes. Guys, I'm having so much fun. My other real quick question or comment was about the coffee and the microwave.
Okay.
My theory, I haven't tested it yet, my theory is it's basically a reaction of the coffee molecules trying to escape from the microwave because microwave coffee does not taste like real coffee.
Oh, we talked about that last time, too.
The oils and whatnot in there. Yeah. Okay.
Just a theory, man.
Okay.
Just a theory.
No, it's proven.
Here's my real...
Yeah. Twice heated coffee does not taste the same.
All right, Joan, what's the real question?
The real question is in regard to weather observations, so it segues wonderfully from the cumulus clouds. watching the animals, watching my own reaction to gardening, I'm almost able to discern trends in the patterns of, like, I definitely plant a little earlier. I definitely am surprised by July and June heat waves and August, September weather. Are there any scientifically derived evidence of the current weather patterns? I know where we're going in the future if we don't change, but right now.
You mean that they've changed?
Well, I know that they've changed. Is there any scientific methodology being looked at as to, we are definitely seeing, for example, wetter springs in our northeast neighbors. And
they're looking at it, all right.
I don't want to tell you. Yeah. So we are seeing current, in the real-time changes, any particular patterns being proven scientifically.
Yeah, you say you're a gardener, right? So you understand what a zone map is.
Zone map, yeah.
Right, I'm watching that methodology. Yeah, so like that.
So the zone map has changed from 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And what we used to be zone 3/4 around here, now we're zone 4/5. So that means that our winters are not as cold as they used to be on average. Or even the coldest part of winter is not as cold as it used to be. Therefore, we have graduated to a warmer zone. So that... It takes the USDA a lot to change a zone map. Like, it's a big deal. So they have spent considerable time looking at trends, and currently they have already changed the map.
Okay. All right, Joan.
What's okay.
Go ahead.
All right. Any information about water, like floodplain changes, obviously, again, to our east?
Well, one of the... With climate change, you can kind of predict long-term trends. For specific events, it comes down to predicting or explaining an increased probability of that event occurring. So for a given flood, the climatologist may be able to work out that that flood was twice as probable as it would have been without climate change, but not being able to say specifically that was the cause. Yeah. It's just that it made it more probable.
Yeah, the Geological Survey has maps out, and the maps have the 50-year flood line, for example, or the 100-year flood line, and those are changing. The trick is that they're very back-looking. It takes them a long time to be willing to change these things. So, you know, it takes 20 years or so before the lines really change enough.
All right, Joan, we're going to let you go there, but thank you very much. Appreciate the call. It's the Science Forum, and it's Barbara Brabets and Ed Stander, Kevin Knuth, and Jim Pickett. We go to Lake George. Ruth, how's the weather up in Lake George?
Well, I'm up in Lake George, and it's beautiful. Oh. However, the cell phone coverage is horrible.
Okay.
So I may lose you. I apologize.
10-4. Go ahead.
Okay, if you can hear me, let me know.
So far.
This is a pretty heavy question, and I don't know if it falls within the realm of your experts, but I'm wondering if they're aware of anybody doing research into the association between PFOAs and the rising incidence of autism or pervasive developmental delays.
Well, I'm looking at the biologist.
No, but most of the PFOA, PFAS research that I've seen, especially for in water, which is my area of research, has been focused on cancer and cancer rates. I have not seen anything about neurodivergent tendencies for populations exposed. You always, whenever neurodivergence comes up as a diagnostic tool or as a measure of something increasing or decreasing, it's difficult because in the olden days, we didn't necessarily categorize people the same way that we categorize them now. So if you're looking historically backwards, there's a disconnect between what we would call neurodivergent now and what was neurodivergent then. And in some aspects of what would be considered relatively invisible neurodivergence, if you will, these people, these individuals may be diagnosed now, either self-diagnosed because there's an awareness of it, or the infrastructure is there to diagnose it, whereas before they were just, it would be like Weird Uncle Al.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, I knew him. Ruth,
and
thanks a lot.
Not that they're weird, but that might be how the family saw it.
And of course, the other problem, if I can, is that there's an awful lot of new chemicals in the environment. And in order to say the PFOAs are responsible for it, requires you to have some a very, very exacting development of methodology of determining that that's the problem, because it could be any number of other things as well.
Yeah, you need a mechanism by which that molecule could be acting in that way.
Yep.
And that seems to be a missing link in a lot of these.
Science Forum today. Kevin, you want to add anything to that? It's the Science Forum. Kevin Knuth, Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barbara Bravitz are the panel, and they're here to answer your questions at 800-348-2551. And Richard is in Rensselaer. Richard.
Hi. Yes, a question about executions lately. Some have been done by having the convict breathe pure nitrogen, and I was wondering, wouldn't pure carbon dioxide be quicker and easier to do since it can be stored at room temperature?
No, we don't have too many execution questions on the science panel, so let's see.
Burning breathing carbon dioxide hurts. It produces carbonic acid in your lungs, and it burns like crazy. It would be painful and pretty much torture.
I don't know anything about executing a person by basically suffocating them with a gas, but you can buy a tank of nitrogen that's at room temperature already, and it's not any more or less available than carbon dioxide. So
okay.
It's not an issue of availability or of any kind of technological challenge.
Richard.
Okay, and I also want to say that the Benz was originally called caisson disease because it was discovered with workers in caissons, I think, digging for the George Washington Bridge. These caissons were a large steel box with the bottom missing that they put in the river, and then they compressed it so the water wouldn't fill the thing up. And the workers went in through an airlock, and they dug the mud out the bottom. And when the day was done, they came out, and they got very sick or died from the bends, and they didn't know what it was.
Somebody emailed that exact statement and exact example. Was that you, Richard?
No.
Wow. Two people thinking exactly alike. Anybody want to comment on that?
Well, it's also called nitrogen narcosis because it gets into your bloodstream. And it's called the bends because that's what happens to your body. If it starts happening, you start to bend over caused by it.
And there's a bit of intoxication. The narcosis piece also implies that your brain doesn't really function well. So like other poisonings like alcohol, the brain is going to give you a bit of euphoria and a little bit of dysphoria as well while you're undergoing this process.
Science Forum here on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is the number. And Richard, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it. Let's grab one more call, then we'll take a break, go back to the email bag, add more phones. Let's go to LaGrangeville, and it's Patrick's turn. Hello, Patrick.
Oh, I was wondering if any of the scientists knew why ice melts.
Why ice melts?
I'm kidding.
Okay, good.
My question is that, say you're taking you're on a roadway and you need to make immediate U-turn, and you come to a spot where it's safe to make a U-turn, and you turn your wheel, the steering wheel, say if you're in the left lane and you turn your wheel all the way to the left. If you go really slow, you're likely not to hit the right curb. But if you give it too much gas, even though the wheel is turned all the way, you're likely to hit the curb.
That doesn't make sense to me. Anybody?
Yeah, that'd be the case only if the tires are slipping on the pavement, and I don't think.
And of course, it depends on whether you put the brakes on fast enough.
And if it's rear-wheel drive or front-wheel drive.
So now we've heard from everybody but the physicist.
I'm not sure what to add except that if you hit the gas hard, even though the wheel is turned all the way to the left and you think you got the room not to hit the curb, you do. But if you only go slowly, you can make the turn without hitting the curb.
Kevin Knuth, professor of physics and stuff. What do you think?
I don't have much here. I'm not sure exactly what you're describing, to be honest. And I'm still stuck on the why ice melt question, which is where I thought we were going with this. But, you know, that's why they call them snowbanks, because you bank off them.
Well. All right. Well, Patrick, I think you've stumped the panel. And frankly, I'm not sure that we could repeat that. I think that if all things being equal, it doesn't happen that way.
I'm out of ice cream, so I'll take it home for
homework assignment.
Okay, Patrick. Ed's going to do this one before next month's show.
Why does ice cream melt anyway? Thank you.
We'll also have that one for homework. Let's take a break, Zach, before anything happens. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. The Science Forum. We'll be back. Lovely music from Henry Mancini and the orchestra. That's Joanna here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabitz, Kevin Knuth, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander, the Science Forum, and Barry in Peterville. Peter in Barryville writes, back in the heart of winter, I asked you crack panel of scientists why 70 degrees in a heated house feels colder than 70 degrees on a summer day. I was advised that it had to do with the lack of moisture in the air in the house. If that's the case, why then do I feel colder when I'm outside on a 30-degree damp day than I do on a dry day with the same temperature?
We also talked about the floor being colder in wintertime than in summertime. That was one contribution by our friend Ed here, who has underfloor radiant heating, and said that, you know, his 70-degree house, when your feet feel a different temperature, that you perceive it as colder or hotter. And so that was an extra piece to that puzzle.
But we're talking about 30 degrees, whether it's humid, or 30 degrees when it's not humid outside. That was the question.
He said wet and damp outside, but isn't that the wetness on your skin? Isn't
it's the evaporation of the wetness on your skin as well, which is going to cause it to cool off.
All right. Nick writes in, how is plastic made to be so strong? Really, a 3D house? And that's from Nick.
Well, plastic is strong because the molecules are very long and entangle with each other. So depending on how rigid the molecule is, it changes the strength of the plastic.
Okay.
So, like, for example, polyethylene is a very wiggly molecule. So it's easy to bend. It's not particularly strong. Kevlar, on the other hand, is a very rigid molecule, and it doesn't move around too much, so it's very strong.
Okay.
And part of the design of the monomer, which is the base molecule that then is daisy chained together, is whether or not it's only going to daisy chain in two directions or whether it's going to daisy chain in three or more directions. So you can get cross-linked polymers, which make them strong in two directions as opposed to strong in just one direction.
All right. This one's from John. A lot of heat and humidity questions here on the show. Heat exchanger efficiency is John's subject heading. Can the panel discuss how a heat exchanger's efficiency can be greater than 100%, especially with respect to the law of conservation of energy? And that's from John.
We have a lot of scrunchy faces right now because we didn't know that there could be a heat efficiency greater than 100%.
It doesn't make sense to
me.
No.
I wonder if it's per some other standard that no longer exists, and it's the new and improved efficiency. You know how businesses like to do the new and improved.
Well, certainly the heat exchanger, if the air is going through it fast, can cool it off or heat it up faster. In other words, the speed in which the air goes through it, you get more or less heat exchange. So that can adjust. That can be adjusted depending on how the heat exchanger is made. But I can't see besides that how it could be any higher or lower.
All right, we'll do one more email, and then we'll go back to the phones. It's the Science Forum here on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. This one's from Garrett. Garrett writes, I have read about a theory that has yet to be disproven regarding that our universe could be that of a hologram, almost at as 2D looks 3D from stored info. I'm just wondering what the panel's thoughts are and if they've heard of this. By the way, if you're writing a letter, punctuation is great. A run-on sentence is not the best way for me to sound like I can read, which I really, you know, I'm not that good at it to begin with. Help me out here. Check your work and punctuate. All right, what do you guys think? The hologram universe.
Well, usually this has to do with the hologram principle, which has to do with the fact that you can get information about what's inside something from its boundary. And so it's more of a theoretical idea, but it doesn't really. But that aspect of the theory doesn't really mean that the universe is a hologram, like a hologram that you see on your credit card.
I'm still confused.
Yeah, I think it's one of those theories because I've encountered the term before. I really don't understand it, and I don't think that it is necessary to explain what we currently know about the universe. It's good clickbait.
Yeah, for sure. And what one thing we need is more physics clickbait. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's very exciting. Let's see. Why don't we go to Troy? Troy, Bill, you're on.
Oh, outstanding. I just wanted to point out that the nitrogen narcosis is something that you can experience aside from decompression sickness when you all were talking about the bends. The bends, the decompression sickness, but nitrogen narcosis is something you can experience even, you know, for the guys out there doing hobby lobbying or, you know, scuba diving. And usually nitrogen narcosis kicks in about 99 feet or after 99 feet. They used to tell us it was like Martini's Law, you know, beyond 99 feet, it's like having another martini. And
now you have my interest.
Yeah. Well, if you go deep enough on air, then it is just like getting drunk, you know, it's like you're going along you guys finished a bottle of Bacardi or something.
Yeah.
It's called cheap. Rapture of the Deep. Right?
Rapture of the Deep.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's quite cheap, actually.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. It's one of the only free highs that you can get.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Until you try to pet the shark.
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, that's a bad idea.
Bill, thanks a lot. And I think I've had the bends from martinis at one time or other. Tom in Albany. Tom, you're on.
Hey, I think we've all had the bends from, you know, Bacardi at one point.
Yeah, buddy.
However, I did want to speak briefly just to the previous caller a minute ago that asked about melting ice cream and then turning a steering wheel. One, that person should check their alignment and balance of their tires. And I'm not trying to, like...
No, I hear you, man.
I don't own a mechanic shop or anything like that, but it's no different than, like, drift cars. Those cars have a force going forward, and you have slippage, which one of the panelists had spoken to as well. You have a slippage of wheel and a force going forward. So the greater the force is, you are going to go outside of your intended lane. That's all it is.
Yeah, I mean, you've clearly watched Fast and Furious, the whole set. Yeah, because my kids watch those movies.
I don't want to throw up like that.
Believe me, I don't, you know, but they drift a lot in those
God
movies.
Bless.
Thanks, man. Appreciate the call. All right.
You know, I was just thinking that it also could have a lot to do with how squishy the tires are. If you have tires that don't have a lot of air in them,
yes,
that can cause it to do that, depending on whether it's going fast or slow.
Or treads, the tread wear and everything else.
Yep.
Sure. Genius. Thanks, Ed.
It's a pleasure.
Let's go to Albany. It's Michael. You're on.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, thank you so much for your very informative program.
Well, thank you.
And day to day, we see all sorts of shapes in our lives, squares, rectangles, trapezoids, and circles. So I was just wondering, why are manhole covers round?
Why are manhole covers round?
There's a knit, yeah. There's actually a reason for that.
Okay.
If they were square, they could fall into the manhole, because if you put it up on edge and rotate a little bit, now that edge,
the hypotenuse is longer.
Yeah, the hypotenuse, it will fit down in it, whereas a round one can't fall into the hole.
Ha! Huh. Well, Michael, that was a great question.
That is a good question. I did not know, think of that. Yeah.
You know, I have a follow-up question that's totally unrelated.
You're sure you don't want to quit while you're ahead? No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, if you can answer this one, you would certainly improve civilization by 100%.
Okay.
Hearing aids. Hearing aids, and I wear them, and I've had several different makes and models, and I can never replicate the high-pitched sounds that I guess the cilia of my ears were able to pick up before they were blown away. So why is it that someone can't invent a hearing aid that will replicate the silica in your ear to pick up those high vibrations, high frequency sounds?
Yeah, I'll try that one. Yeah, I can't improve a civilization until computers get a little bit better. But what happens in a typical hearing aid, just to simplify it down as much as I can, is what it does is it amplifies the sound and puts it as close to the dysfunctional but yet functioning part of your ear that is there. So just beyond your eardrum, there's this little thing called the cochlea. And the cochlea is a little spiral that's full of fluid. And in that, it has very special cells that have proteins that stick out like hairs. So we talk about them like hairs, but they're not actually hairs. They're pieces of protein at the molecular level. And they wave at frequencies based upon how short or how long they are. The short ones, because the high frequency has more energy, tend to break off more. So if all of your short hairs are broken off inside your cochlea, then you can't perceive that high-pitched sound, no matter how much that high-pitched sound is hitting your eardrum. So the problem is really not the transmission to your head or to your brain. It's more that you can't receive that information because there's no structure left in your ear to hear it. So with cochlear implants, as you know, for people who are profoundly deaf or have lost almost all their hearing and they're willing to lose the residual hearing that they have, then what they do is they bypass the reception altogether, the perception of sound, and then take an electrical signal and send it through the nerve that is then translated by your brain as sound. And so by getting rid of the, you know, microphone part of your ear and going straight to the transmission, they're able to give
Amazing.
Sound back to people who don't have that apparatus anymore or it never worked. So when computers get better, what hearing aids will be available for those of us who are just hard of hearing is to do a less invasive implant directly into the brain, and you can receive information directly into
Incredible.
Your brain.
Michael.
And a USB port brain.
Good call. Appreciate it very much. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's the Science Forum. And now, topics get going, and then everybody wants to talk about them. Now it's about curbs and turning, and let's go to Eddie. Eddie, you're on.
Oh, hi. I'm a former driving instructor. I taught teenagers in L.A. as well as grew up Oof. Having to parallel park in New York City. And here's my answer to that driving question.
Okay.
If you go slowly, I've watched people do this. If you drive quickly, you can't turn the wheel to the left fast enough. And so you go out straight and increase the radius of your turn. If you turn the wheel just as you're moving, or if you drive out straight 5 or 10 feet and then cut it all the way, you can make a narrower turn. So it's really about the driver's mechanical skills, not so much as the car. That's my humble opinion.
Makes sense.
Okay, well,
you
it's possible.
You just got to turn the wheel sooner.
It's possible.
And if you go slowly, you can turn the wheel faster. If you go fast, you can't turn it fast enough to make the turn tight.
True. The fellow said that he turned the wheel before he makes the turn.
He had it cranked all the way before he made the turn.
All the way, as far as possible.
Which doesn't make sense to me.
No, which is why I have to take it home and have some ice cream.
All right, Eddie, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. And now to, North Bennington. Alex in North Bennington, you're on.
Hi, this is the same topic. There's sliding, there's kinetic friction, there's static friction. When your car is moving slow, the static friction is what it is. And when you're going faster, that static friction is, that coefficient of friction is dropped. So your tires are not hitting, are not gripping the road the way it is when your car is moving slow. So that's, so it's sliding. So the tires are sliding.
What do you think, panel?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was the suggestion.
The stick slip model of friction. That makes sense.
You all right?
Although it's still slipping. It's not keeping contact with the road. That's the basic thing.
All right, Alex, thanks a lot. And I think we've exhausted that one. Let's go now to Mary in Valencia. Mary, you got a minute or two here. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep. Hello?
Hello.
You're on.
For some reason, okay. I'm calling on behalf of my father, Sam Girardi. He's 92 years old. Was in the Air Force, flew a lot of planes, and his concern is he's got a program, an app called Flight Tracker 24. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that.
They're nodding. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So he will track flights. Like if I'm traveling, he'll track my flight. And when I get home, it's like, do you know how many planes are up there at the same time? And the heights that they're at, and he'll rip off all the altitudes, the speeds. And his concern is, if we're so concerned about climate change, what are we doing about those high temperatures being emitted from the jet engines, for the environment? Is there anything being done on that?
All right, panel, what do you think? Got about a minute.
Yeah, well, it's probably not the temperature per se, but it's the amount of carbon dioxide that's being produced from the combustion of jet fuel that is being tracked most vigorously. If you buy a ticket now on any kind of app, it'll tell you how many pounds of CO2 or kilograms of CO2 are associated with the production of that flight. No, that's absolutely true.
Wow.
Now, again, what's the alternative? Yeah. If I need to go to Japan, I can't swim. So, do I fly to New York or do I take a train to New York? It's cost less in CO2 if I take a train from Albany to New York City than I do. Blimp will work. I'll hitchhike. Anyway, so there is an awareness of that addition for the CO2 accumulation in our atmosphere, the carbon dioxide increase in our atmosphere, and how much flights contribute. And of course, airlines want as fuel efficient as a vehicle as possible. So a lot of the move to some of these newer ones is because they're more fuel efficient than the old 737, 757, 747.
All right, Mary, thanks a lot. We'll have to leave it there. Final email here from James. Here's a question that's always puzzled me, says James. Why is it that no matter what breed it is, all wet dogs smell the same? It doesn't even matter if the dog is clean or dirty. Everyone knows that familiar wet dog smell. Why do all wet dogs smell alike? Kevin Knuth.
I don't have a dog.
Yeah. Dogs have a musk, just like humans.
Right.
And part of their smell profile that we can't tell the difference of, they certainly can. They can tell one individual from another and the gender.
So why is it worse when they're wet?
Because you're aerosolizing that musk.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you, everyone on the panel. That was a real big, stirring finish to the program. Thanks to Barbara Brabets and Jim Pickett and Ed Stander and Kevin Knuth for being here. Support comes from Berkshire South Regional Community Center of Great Barrington, offering fitness classes, indoor swimming, preschool, youth activities, events, and community programming for all ages. BerkshireSouth.org. Historic Albany Foundation, announcing the 2024 Preservation Merit Award, celebrating projects and individuals and organizations that demonstrate a commitment to preservation on September 25th. historicalbany.org. And Fadigan's Nursery, Latham, New York, featuring flowering planters, annuals, perennials, vegetable and herb starts, organic soils. Over 100 years of gardening experience, family-owned and operated, Fadigan's.com. Ed and Barbara and Kevin and Jim did a great job. You all did a great job. Thanks for calling in. Thanks for writing in. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, who we woke up just in time to end the show. Thanks to Susie Chekai, who screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Food Friday. The Hudson Valley Garlic Festival happens at... Oh, the Hudson Valley Garlic Festival. This is exciting. It happens later this month. There is a Mohawk Valley Garlic Festival coming up this weekend. We're going to talk garlic tomorrow. It's going to stink. We'll see you.